Here is Radio New York Folk Music Worldwide. A program devoted to the best in folk music throughout the world, showcasing the top performers and authorities in the field. Now your host for Folk Music Worldwide, Alan Wasser.
We're privileged to have in our studios today the man who Alan Lomax calls the best all-around folk performer, Mr. Peter Seeger. We will listen to some of Mr. Seeger's recordings, and we'll be talking with him about his life, his songs, and folk music in general. Mr. Seeger, the obvious first question is, just how do you define folk music?
I think you have to accept the fact that hardly any two people, not even the experts, agree on a definition. You see, way back in the old days, say in Europe of the Middle Ages, you had an aristocracy and they could afford to pay for musicians. And the kings and queens had musicians in the castles, and that developed into symphony orchestras and what we call classical music now. But folks out in the country couldn't afford to pay for anybody else to make music. They had to make their own. And so the peasantry had their music, and it was given about 100 years ago, given the name of folk music. In the United States, many people said, well, you can't have folk music in the United States because you don't have any peasant class. But the funny thing was that there were literally thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who loved old-time fiddling, ballads, banjo tunes, blues played on the guitar, spirituals and gospel hymns. And these songs and music didn't fit into any neat category of art music, nor popular music, nor jazz. So gradually they said, well, let's call it folk music. But as I say, no two people agree on the term. I don't argue about it myself. It's like two people arguing about the definition of beer. Now, you put a glass of New York beer in front of a Londoner, and he spits it out. He said, phew, that cold, tasteless stuff, bring me some beer. Now, you put a glass of London beer in front of a New Yorker, and he'll spit it out. You mean that warm, sour stuff? He says, bring me some beer. I don't get in an argument. If I'm in London, why, I'll drink the beer there, and if I'm in New York, I'll drink the beer there, but I don't get in an argument about the definition.
Well, how did you first actually get interested in folk music?
Well, I was about 16 years old, back in 1935, and my father was a professor of musicology. He took me down to a square dance festival in North Carolina, and for the first time in my life, I found there was music in my country that you never heard on the radio, and you didn't hear on the jukeboxes, and theaters. I fell in love with it, especially the long-neck banjo. As a matter of fact, let me ask you to play one of the first tunes I learned back in those days. It's a mountain banjo tune called Oh Liza, Poor Gal.
Well, let's hear that now.
Oh Liza, poor gal, oh Liza Jane, oh Liza, poor gal, she died on the train. I'm going up on the mountain top, plant me a patch of cane. I'm gonna make molasses to sweeten Liza Jane. Oh, Liza, poor gal, oh, Liza Jane. Oh, Liza, poor gal, she died on the train. You go down that old fence road, I'll go down the lane. You can hug an old fence post, I'll hug Liza Jane. Oh, Liza, poor gal, oh, Liza Jane. Oh, Liza, poor gal, she died on the train. She died on the train.
The banjo was originally an African instrument. And then in the southern plantations, the slaves figured a new way of playing it, which was half European and half African. Around the year 1830, the banjo was picked up by white people, and it swept America just like rock and roll music did 100 years later. Banjos were everywhere. A man could make one himself. They went west in the covered wagons. then it kind of died out as popular music styles change. And in the 1930s, when I was a teenager, I wanted to learn it, and the only place I could learn it was back in the hills. And when I got out of school, I spent 2 years just hitchhiking around. Every time I met some old farmer who could play it, I'd get him to teach me a lick or two. And little by little, I put it together.
Where did you go from there in your folk music?
Well, I never intended to make a living at it. That's the funny thing. I wanted to be a journalist, but I couldn't get a job as one. I remember one editor telling me, he says, young man, he said, I had to lay off one of my best reporters last week, and you expect me to hire you, and you've had no experience. So I used to pick up change, mostly singing in schools, summer camps, and places like that. Well, by and by, the kids grew up and went to college, and so 10 years ago, I used to get requests from college students to come out and sing for them. Lo and behold, it's now developed into a big commercial field. There's dozens of performers putting on hundreds of concerts, thousands of them perhaps, every year, in the thousands of American universities and colleges. People like Odetta, Richard Dyer Bennett, Kingston Trio, of course. And what I'm especially happy about is at last the college students have realized that some of the very best folk musicians are real country people.
I understand you knew Leadbelly, the famous old folk singer.
Yeah, and when I stopped to think of it, I think he was my main music teacher, although he didn't know it. I'd follow him around and watch his hands closely, and I admired him so. I remember someone once saying, Pete, you know, you really should take voice lessons. And I said, well, if I could find any voice teacher that would teach me to sing like Leadbelly, I'd spend every cent to study under him. But every time you go to a voice teacher, he teaches you to warble as if you want to be an opera singer, and that's not what I'm interested in. Well, Leadbelly died in 1949, but he taught us a lot of the best songs we'll ever know. He never made any great deal of money out of his music, but I think he'll live forever in the young people that are singing his songs, like Rock Island Line, Old Cotton Fields at Home, Midnight Special, Bring Me a Little Water, Sylvie. Come to think of it, the first hit record that I and the Weavers ever had was his theme song. Maybe people ought to hear it now. It's Good Night, Irene.
Another stroll downtown. Let me hear it now.
Irene, good night. Irene, good night. Good night, Irene. Good night, Irene. I'll see you in my dream.
Sometimes I live in the country.
That's quite a song, that really is. And you tell us something about the Weavers. This recording we had was with the Weavers.
This was a Carnegie Hall concert of 1955, And the members of the Weavers are two New Yorkers, Ronnie Gilbert with a vibrant alto voice, Fred Helleman with a kind of a low baritone, and Lee Hayes, who used to be a preacher in Arkansas with a kind of a bass. Me, I'm a split tenor.
What's a split tenor?
Well, I sometimes sing in falsetto and sometimes high, sometimes growl. I don't really have a voice, as you can tell right now. I get by mostly by default. But the Weavers showed that folk music could be good entertainment in the cities. And following them came the Kingston Trio and the Gateway Singers and half a dozen others. Peter, Paul, and Mary are the latest ones. They're all friends of ours. Mary Travers in Peter, Paul, and Mary was in a little singing group I had here in New York when she was just a high school student.
Really? I see why they consider you the patriarch of folk music.
Oh, Lord. It's a terrible thing being a patriarch, and I don't even have a gray beard. But people keep calling me up for advice, and try as I may to tell them that I'm no authority, and I can't even give advice to my own children. At least they don't take it. I get called a high priest, dean. What worse names can you call people?
Yes, I speaking of your family, your whole family are folk music singers these days, aren't they?
Well, my father married twice, and I was the youngest of the first batch, and Michael Seeger and Peggy Seeger are the oldest of the second batch. They're wonderful musicians. I think Mike is one of the greatest instrumentalists I've ever heard in my life, and I think Peggy is one of the greatest ballad singers I've ever heard in my life. She's married to Ewan McCall, the English folk singer now, and she's a subject of Her Majesty over there. I have three children myself, and my wife and I and the three of them plan to take off this summer and visit some different parts of the world. Perhaps we'll come to the countries where some of your listeners are.
Which countries?
In September, we'll be in Australia and New Zealand. In October and November, we'll be in Japan. I don't know exactly what short stops we'll make between, but we'll be in India around December, and in several African countries during January. In February, we'll be in Italy, and during March and April and May, other countries of Europe.
Yes, I've always wondered, on these tours, do you get more songs than you sing, or is it the other way around?
Oh, I have to resist the temptation to want to learn everything. You know you can't. You have to restrict yourself at some time, or else you just find yourself being spread too thin. And already, I think I try too many things. Occasionally, I'll sing a song from Japan, or try and make my banjo sound like a sitar from India, or some Eastern European dance, or an Israeli song. One of the first hit records the Weavers had was Tzena Tzena from Israel. And as a matter of fact, one of my all-time favorite songs is a song from South Africa. I learned it off a phonograph record about 12 or 13 years ago. I had a cold, as I have now. I was in bed, though, and I listened to this record over and over, admiring it. And suddenly I realized that it was quite simple. The basses did the same thing over and over again. And the tenors did the same thing over and over again. And the fellow singing falsetto did. So I tried learning it. I didn't think I could hit that high note until I just screwed up my courage and opened my mouth wide, took a deep breath and let it out, and sure enough I hit it. It's the highest note I'm able to hit. But this song, which originally I just did as a novelty, ended up by being one of my favorites, and I think other people's favorites too. Here it is with the Weavers helping out on it. It's called Wimawe, or down in South Africa it's Mbube, which means the lion.
Thank you.
Miss Everly, what does that mean?
Well, you know, people often ask me what songs mean, and it's important. These songs do mean something. There's a story behind every old ballad or work song or nonsense song that I ever knew. And sometimes it's a fascinating story, a story of people struggling for freedom and struggling to get along in this old world. This particular song, of course, I've never been to South Africa, but I found out it means one phrase, the lion is sleeping, the lion, the lion, the lion. The lion is sleeping, the lion, the lion, the lion. Well, what would that mean? I think you'd have to be in South Africa to realize exactly what it means. The last king of the Zulu people was a great military chieftain named Chaka the Lion. And after he was killed and the Europeans took over that part of the world, the legend arose, as I'm sure it has in other parts of the world, that Chaka the Lion was not dead. He simply went to sleep and would wake up sometime to lead his people to freedom. So you think of what's going on in South Africa today and think why this song was so powerful.
There's another song of a similar background, I imagine, that has also always confused me. Follow the Drinking Gourd.
Well, back in the 1850s, there were some very brave Americans who risked their lives to try and help slaves escape from the South to freedom in Canada. And this song comes from that period. It consists of some new words to an old Methodist hymn. The Methodist song was called Follow the Risen Lord.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry you the freedom. Follow the drinking gourd.
Now when the sun comes back and the first quail calls, follow the drinking gourd. The old man is a-waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is a-waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd.
The bank will make a mighty good road. The dead trees will show you the way. Left foot, pink foot, traveling on. Follow the drinking gourd.
Follow the drinking gourd. Follow the drinking gourd. For the old man is waiting for to carry you to freedom. Follow the drinking gourd.
At some point, somebody changed the words slightly, and they, you can imagine the slave singing it in the fields, and the overseer comes down and with his whip and says, well, I like to hear them all singing, that means they're happy. And there they were singing a song which was giving a timetable and a set of directions for slaves to escape to the north. Now, the drinking gourd, of course, is double talk for the Big Dipper, which is in the north sky, pointing to the North Star and where freedom was. Of course, it's a little bit dangerous to always assume that you know exactly what the meanings of a song are. It's interesting, though, to analyze what meanings could be. For example, one of the most favorite of all the old English ballads is a song called Barbara Allen. And I've heard scholars discuss for hours on end why that song should be more popular than any other ballad that ever came here from England. Is it because the men are trying to prove how cruel the girls are? You know, she won't even give him one last kiss, and so he dies for love of her. And on the other hand, do they like it simply because it's a beautiful melody? But there are several different melodies used for it. Do they like it because it's beautiful poetry? But hardly any one verse is found in every version. You see, everybody's got their own way of singing it. One verse, however, is always included. It's the last verse, which describes the briar growing out of the grave of Barbara Allen, the cruel girl, and the red rose growing out of the grave of Sweet William, the boy who died for love of her. And it describes them going up the wall and intertwining at the top in a lover's knot. Well, you listen to the song, and at the end I'll tell you what my interpretation of that is.
In Scarlet Town, where I was born, there was a fair maid dwelling, made many a youth cry, well-a-day, and her name was Barbary Allen. 'Twas in the merry month of May, when green buds they were swelling, Sweet William came from the west country, and he courted Barbary Allen. He sent his servant unto her, to the place where she was dwelling. Said, my master's sick, bids me call for you, if your name be Barbary Allen. Well, slowly, slowly got she up, and slowly went she nigh him. But all she said as she passed his bed, young man, I think you're dying. Then lightly tripped she down the stairs. She heard those church bells tolling, and each bell seemed to say as it tolled, hard-hearted Barbary Allen. Oh, mother, mother, go make my bed, and make it long and narrow. Sweet William died for me today, I'll die for him tomorrow. They buried Barbara in the old churchyard, they buried Sweet William beside her. Out of his grave grew a red, red rose, and out of hers a briar. They grew and grew up the old church wall, till they could grow no higher. And at the top, twined in a lover's knot, the red rose and the briar.
Well, I think it means that everybody in this world at some time experiences cruelty, or perhaps is cruel and regrets it. And this song holds out some kind of sublimated hope that maybe there'll be reconciliation in some way, either in this world or the next or somewhere.
I'm very sorry, but I'm afraid our time is up. Mr. Seeger, I can't tell you how much we appreciate your coming in and being our guest.
This has been Folk Music Worldwide. Next week, Mr. Wass's guest will be Paul Stuckey of the famous trio Peter, Paul, and Mary. If you have any comments or requests, write to Folk Music Worldwide, Radio New York Worldwide, New York 19, USA. This has been a Music Worldwide presentation.